DTC ads. Selling is the name of the game. Drug advertising is now ubiquitous in all major media outlets. Despite spending 7.1% less on direct-to-consumer or DTC drug advertising in the third quarter of fiscal 2008, a Nielsen Media Research report showed that pharmaceutical firms still spent about $4.8 billion on DTC advertising for television, radio, and print ads in magazines and newspapers. Here's how the top few drugs worked out in sales per advertising dollar spent. The cholesterol drug Lipitor earned $34.09 for each ad dollar spent. The asthma drug Advair Diskus earned $27.98 per ad dollar. The heartburn remedy Nexium earned $44.92 per ad dollar. The allergy drug Singulair earned $45.24 per ad dollar. The allergy medication Zyrtec, now available without prescription, earned $33.86 per ad dollar. DTC advertising more than tripled between 1997 and 2005, growing from $1.3 billion to $4.2 billion since the U.S. Food and Drug Administration eased restrictions governing these types of drug ads. It has been estimated that $8 billion of the $235 billion spent by consumers on prescription drugs in 2008 came from DTC advertising, and the 2008 decline in DTC advertising, a first in recent U.S. history, was offset by launch campaigns on drugs such as Cialis, Abilify, Nasonex, and Plavix. While TV ads show visuals of happy people, idyllic countrysides, laughing children, and playful pets, a droning audio voice rapidly skips through possible side effects. The pain medication Vioxx was heavily advertised by its maker, but later recalled when it was shown the drug increased the risk of heart attack in some people. The fact that it was so heavily marketed magnified its ultimate damage, said Michael Russo, a healthcare proponent for the public advocacy group California Public Interest Research Group, or CalPIRG. Perhaps Big Pharm cares more for promoting their drugs than developing something better and safer. Published estimates predict that whereas the drug industry spent about $57.5 billion on U.S. marketing in 2004, it spent only $31.5 billion on research and development. Percentage-wise, of the $235.4 billion in U.S. sales in 2004, promotion consumed 24.4% of sales dollars, while R&D only took 13.4%. Although some academic studies suggest that DTC advertising can help people who need to start taking drugs and others to remain compliant with existing treatment regimens, the lack of fair balance in many DTC ads that promote drug benefits and downplay risks is what is driving legislation to curb its use, stated a comment posted on biojobblog.com, a website dedicated to bioindustry employment. Interestingly, about 10 years ago, a friend who works for a major pharmaceutical company told me that she always waits 5 years before using a new approved drug. At the time, I thought it was an odd thing for her to say since she had been in the business for over 15 years. However, over the past 5 years or so, several high-profile drugs that were heavily promoted by DTC advertising had to be withdrawn from the market. To that end, while DTC advertising may be great for business, it may not always be in the best interest of American consumers who use prescriptions. The site also noted that DTC advertising is allowed in only two countries, New Zealand and the United States. The ever-increasing predominance of DTC drug advertising has prompted several members of Congress to introduce legislation to curtail the ads. Legislators were disgusted with tax deductions for drug marketers using DTC advertising and commercials offering products that gave four-hour erections during primetime television hours. Not only did drug advertising trouble the public, but so did the disproportion of actual drug costs to retail sale price. In 2003, the website ThePeople'sVoice.org posted this chart of the actual price of active ingredients used in some of the most popular drugs sold in America. This chart shows four columns labeled brand name, consumer price per 100, costs of general active ingredients per 100 tablets or capsules, and the percent markup. Brand name, Celebrex 100 milligrams. Consumer price per 100, $130.27. Cost of general active ingredients per 100 tablets or capsules, 60 cents. Percent markup, 21,712%. Brand name Claritin, 10 milligrams, $215.17 consumer price per 100. 71 cents cost of general active ingredients per 100 tablets or capsules. 30,306% markup. Keflex, 250 milligrams, $157.39 consumer price per 100. $1.88 cost of general active ingredients per 100 tablets or capsules. 8,372% markup. Lipitor, 20 milligrams, $272.37 consumer price per 100, $5.80 cost of general active ingredients per 100 tablets or capsules, 4,696% markup. Norvasc, 10 milligrams, $188.29 consumer price, 14 cents cost of general active ingredients, 134,493% markup. Paxil, 20 milligrams, $220.27, $7.60, 2,898%. Prevacid, 3C3, 30 milligrams, $44.77, $1.01, 34,136%. Prilosec, 20 milligrams, $360.97, 52 cents, 69,417% markup. Prozac, 20 milligrams, $247.47 consumer price, 11 cents cost of general active ingredients, 224,973% markup. Tenormin, 50 milligrams, $104.47 consumer price, 13 cents general cost of active ingredients, 80,362% markup. Vasotec, 10 milligrams, $102.37, 20 cents, 51,185%. Xanax, 1 milligram, $136.79 consumer price, 2.4 cents cost of general active ingredients, 569,958% markup. Zestril, 20 milligrams, $89.89, $3.20 cost of general active ingredients, 2,809% markup. Zithromax, 600 milligrams, $1,482.19 consumer price, $18.78 cost of general active ingredients, 7,892% markup. Zocor, 40 milligrams, $350.27, $8.63, 4,059% markup. Zoloft, 50 milligrams, $206.87 consumer price per 100, $1.75 cost of general active ingredients per 100 tablets or capsules, 11,821% markup. Fortunately, the government has acted in response to the growing public awareness of big farm malfeasance. In September 2009, Pfizer Incorporated, the world's largest drug manufacturer, was ordered to pay a record $2.3 billion civil and criminal penalty after the government found the firm guilty of unlawful prescription drug promotions. Prosecutors charged the company with promoting four prescription drugs, including the painkiller Bextra, taken off the market in 2005, after studies indicated that the drugs increased the chances of heart attack and had been used as a treatment for medical conditions different from those for which federal regulators had approved. A spokesman for the Justice Department said the fine, which included both criminal and civil penalties, was the largest criminal fine in U.S. history. Authorities noted that this was the fourth settlement involving false and misleading advertising claims in the past 10 years. They called Pfizer a repeat offender and said the company's conduct would be monitored for the next 5 years. Previously, Pfizer was accused of inviting doctors to all-expense-paid meetings at resorts as consultants. U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Mike Laux said, "They were entertained with golf, massages, and other luxuries." He added that Pfizer continued to violate the same laws with other drugs, even while negotiating the Baxter settlement with Justice Department attorneys. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo told the media, "Pfizer ripped off New Yorkers and taxpayers across the country to pad its bottom line. Pfizer's corrupt practices went so far as sending physicians on exotic junkets, as well as wining and dining healthcare professionals, to persuade them to prescribe the company's drugs for patients in taxpayer-funded programs." Another big farm giant's consolidation efforts point to high-level connections with both the globalists and the Nazis. GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, the second largest pharmaceutical company in the world after Pfizer, was founded in London in 1880 by two American pharmacists, Henry Wellcome and Silas Burroughs, as Burroughs, Wellcome & Company. Glaxo Laboratories, originally a baby food manufacturer, went multinational in 1935. After the post-war acquisition of other companies, including Meyer Laboratories, Glaxo merged with Burroughs Wellcome in 1995. The new name of the company was Glaxo Wellcome. In 2000, after merging with SmithKline Beckham, the firm became GlaxoSmithKline. The original Burroughs Wellcome drug firm was wholly owned by Wellcome Trust, whose director was the British Lord Oliver Franks, a man described as one of the founders of the post-war world. Franks was ambassador to the United States from 1948 to 1952 and was also a director of the Rockefeller Foundation and its principal representative in England. He was a director of the Kurt von Schroeder Nazi Bank, which at one time handled Hitler's personal bank account. Franks also was a director of the Rhodes Trust, which was used in the late 1800s by the African diamond magnate Cecil Rhodes to create his Round Table Groups, a forerunner of the Council on Foreign Relations. As a Rhodes director, Franks was in charge of approving Rhodes scholarships, such as the one awarded Bill Clinton in 1968. According to former intelligence officer Dr. John Coleman, members of Rhodes roundtables, armed with immense wealth gained from control of gold, diamonds, and drugs, fanned out over the world to take control of fiscal and monetary policies and political leadership in all countries where they operated. This conspiratorial network was confirmed by President Clinton's academic mentor, the Georgetown University historian Carol Quigley, who wrote, "There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. I know of the operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or most of its aims, and have, for much of my life, been close to it and many of its instruments. In general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known." While Franks is known as director of the trust that owned a large drug company, most people do not know the extent of the Rockefellers' influence over modern medicine and drugs. According to Eustace Mullins, the drug industry is controlled by a Rockefeller medical monopoly, largely through directors on pharmaceutical boards representing Rockefeller entities. The American College of Surgeons maintained a monopolistic control of hospitals through the powerful Hospital Survey Committee, with members Winthrop Aldrich and David McAlpin Pyle representing the Rockefeller Control. Winthrop Aldrich, whose sister was married to John D. Rockefeller Jr., served as president and board chairman of Chase National Bank from 1930 to 1953. He also served on the Committee of the Cost of Medical Care, CCMC, which was started by Dr. Alexander Lambert, the personal physician to Teddy Roosevelt, and a president of the AMA beginning in 1910. According to Dr. Charles C. Smith, a physician who researched the activities of the committee and published a report in 1984, he, Dr. Lambert, obviously was to be the needed figurehead. The full-time staff was headed by Harry H. Moore of Washington, who in 1927 published American Medicine and the People's Health, while a member of Public Health Service. His main tenets were the need for a system to distribute medical care and an insurance plan to pay for it. So early in the 20th century, administrators and economists were deciding the future of America's health care. Moore was aided by C. Rufus Rorem, who received a Ph.D. in economics at the University of Chicago, which was founded and funded by Rockefeller. Rorem, according to Smith, was more concerned about hospital prepayment than in health care. Following his work for the CCMC, Rorem went on to become executive director of the Blue Cross Plan Commission between 1936 and 1946. I think the most important principle spawned by this committee was not at all what was planned, wrote Dr. Charles C. Smith, Jr., who authored a medical history study paper on the committee. A minority on the committee fruitlessly recommended that government competition in the medical practice be discontinued. They also argued in opposition to corporate medicine being financed through intermediary agencies, such as health maintenance organizations, or HMOs. Allegedly, these types of organizations exploit the medical professions and fail to provide high-quality health care. The tenor of the CCMC report was such that one can read into it the seeds of everything that led to the health care system we have today. So at least we find ourselves, as always, in a health care crisis, Dr. Smith wrote in 1984. This health care crisis continues today. Rockefeller's General Education Board has spent more than $100 million to gain control of the nation's medical schools and turn our physicians to physicians of the allopathic school, dedicated to surgery and the heavy use of drugs, wrote author Mullins, who spent more than 30 years researching the Rockefeller medical monopoly. Recalling how John D. Rockefeller Sr.'s father, William Big Bill Rockefeller, once tried to sell unrefined petroleum as a cancer cure, Mullins wrote, "This carnival medicine show Barker would hardly have envisioned that his descendants would control the greatest and most profitable medical monopoly in recorded history." Mullins reported that the German chemical company IG Farben and its subsidiaries in the United States through the Rockefeller interests, such as the cartel between Rockefeller's U.S.-based Standard Oil Company and IG Farben, as revealed in a 1941 investigation by the government, were responsible for trying to build a monopoly by suppressing discoveries of its own drugs. From 1908 to 1936, IG Farben withheld its discovery of sulfanilamide, an early sulfa drug, until the firm had signed working agreements with the important drug firms of Switzerland, Sandoz and Ciba-Geigy. After years of a working relationship, these two firms were finally joined in 1996 to form one of the largest corporate mergers in history, Novartis. During the first half of the 20th century, the Nazi drug cartel IG Farben, along with the drug companies controlled through Rockefeller interests, dominated the development, production, and distribution of numerous drugs, including substances that are downright dangerous. Aspartame. Americans aren't just being affected by chemicals and pharmaceutically produced drugs. One of the many controversial chemicals now being used by millions of Americans is aspartame, an additive sugar substitute found in most diet soft drinks and more than 5,000 foods, drugs, medicines, and most sugar substitutes such as NutraSweet, Equal, Metamucil, and Canderel. When heated to more than 86 degrees Fahrenheit, aspartame releases free methanol, which breaks down into formic acid and formaldehyde in the body. Keep in mind, the human body temperature is 98.6 degrees, and that formaldehyde is a deadly neurotoxin. The remaining formaldehyde from free methanol then breaks down into formic acid, the venom of ant stings. In 1987, Dr. Louis J. Elsis, a professor of pediatrics and director of the Division of Medical Genetics at Emory University, testified before the U.S. Senate Committee on Labor and Human Resources about phenylalanine, one of the two amino acids in aspartame. He said, "In the developing fetus, such a rise in maternal blood phenylalanine could be magnified 4- to 6-fold by the concentrative efforts of the placental and fetal blood-brain barrier, and this concentration kills such cells in tissue culture. The effect of such an increased fetal brain concentration in vivo would probably be much more subtle and expressed as mental retardation, microcephaly, or potential certain birth defects." When Dr. Elsis told the senators about phenylalanine in 1987, infant autism rates were 1 in 1,500. Today, they are 1 in 150 and rising. It would appear that certain drugs are wrecking our newborn children. Dr. Madeline Price, a professor of neurobiology at Washington University, said, "Aspartic acid, aspartate, has been known to be a neurotoxin for 30 years, now 40 years. Rodents that have ingested too much aspartame as infants are stunted as adults, obese, and have sexual and reproductive dysfunctions." Until the Reagan administration, the Food and Drug Administration had refused to approve the use of aspartame. The FDA's own toxicologist, Dr. Adrian Gross, told Congress that aspartame could contribute to or even cause seizures, brain tumors, and brain cancer, and violated the Delaney Clause, which forbids putting anything in food that is known to cause cancer. "And if the FDA violates its own laws, who is left to protect the public?" he asked. Dr. H. J. Roberts with the Palm Beach Institute for Medical Research devoted an entire chapter of his book, Aspartame Disease, An Ignored Epidemic, to aspartame interaction with drugs such as Coumadin, Dilantin, antidepressants, and other psychotropic agents, as well as Inderol, Aldomet, hormones, and insulin. Roberts said aspartame interacts with all cardiac medication, and even noted drug reactions after a person stopped using aspartame products. The issue of sudden death related to aspartame and its breakdown products has been raised a number of times, particularly among previously well individuals using such products, including pilots and drivers and athletes. He added, "The need for clinicians and corporate neutral investigators to evaluate the contributory role of aspartame in cardiopulmonary disorders and sudden death and drug interactions with aspartame is underscored by the frequency of persons dying unexpectedly being categorized as death due to causes yet to be determined." Dr. Betty Martini, a 22-year veteran in the medical field and founder of Mission Possible International, has worked with doctors around the world to remove aspartame from food, drinks, and medicine. She recounted how pharmaceutical interests subordinated public welfare. Donald Rumsfeld was CEO of Searle, that conglomerate that manufactured aspartame. For 16 years, the FDA refused to approve it, not only because it's not safe, but because they wanted the company indicted for fraud. Both U.S. prosecutors for the FDA hired on with the defense team, and the statute of limitations expired. They were Sam Skinner and William Conlon. Skinner went on to become Secretary of Transportation, squelching the cries of the pilots who were now having seizures on this seizure-triggering drug, aspartame, and then Chief of Staff under President Bush's father. Some of these people reach high places. Even Supreme Justice Clarence Thomas is a former Monsanto attorney. Monsanto bought Searle in 1985 and sold it a few years ago. Yet even with friends in high places, the FDA still refused to allow NutraSweet on the market. Termed a deadly neurotoxic drug masquerading as an additive by opponents, aspartame interacts with antidepressants and also interacts with vaccines and other toxins and unsafe sweeteners like Splenda. Both being excitotoxins, the aspartic acid in aspartame and MSG, the glutamate, people were found using aspartame as the placebo for MSG studies even before it was approved. The FDA has known this for a quarter of a century and done nothing, even though it's against the law. Searle went on to build a NutraSweet factory and had $9 million worth of inventory, said Martini. Donald Rumsfeld was on President Reagan's transition team, and the day after Reagan took office, Dr. Arthur Hall Hayes, the man who would approve aspartame, was appointed as FDA commissioner. Former Searle salesperson Patty Wood Allett supported the idea that Rumsfeld was behind the approval of aspartame by stating that in 1981, Rumsfeld told company employees he would call in all his markers and that no matter what, he would see to it that aspartame be approved that year. FDA Commissioner Hayes had previously served in the U.S. Army Chemical Weapons Division and initially had approved aspartame only as a powdered additive. But in 1983, just before he left his position for a public relations job with Burson Marsteller, the chief public relations firm for both Monsanto and Searle, Hayes approved aspartame for all carbonated beverages. Since that time, he never spoke publicly about aspartame. Hayes died in February 2010. Rumsfeld is merely one example of the cozy relationship between government and Big Pharm. A former CEO of Searle and a member of the Trilateral Commission, a globalist group designed to foster economic cooperation between the United States, Japan, and Europe. Rumsfeld is also a major stockholder in Gilead Sciences, a California biotech firm that owns the rights to Tamiflu. When the population was being threatened with the bird flu in 2005, CNN reported Rumsfeld's Gilead holdings at somewhere between $5 million to $25 million. The incestuous relationship between Big Pharm corporate business and the government makes a mockery of American free enterprise. While it is free to decide which drugs to promote and distribute, it is also free to price them as high as the traffic will bear. Yet Big Pharm is dependent on government in the form of patent protection and FDA approval to protect its drug monopoly. In a move bewildering to those who are not aware of the globalist agenda and its control, Congress expressly prohibited Medicare from negotiating lower drug prices through its bulk purchasing power. The excesses of the globalists' pharmaceutical corporations have prompted many Americans to seek price relief by traveling to Canada or Mexico to purchase drugs. Dr. Angel said the pharmaceutical industry has moved very far from its original high purpose of discovering and producing useful new drugs, and it is now primarily a marketing machine to sell drugs of dubious benefit. Big Pharm uses its wealth and power to co-opt every institution that might stand in its way, including the U.S. Congress, the FDA, academic medical centers, and the medical profession itself, as most of its marketing efforts are focused on influencing doctors, since they must write the prescriptions, she said. Don't look for any real relief from either Democrats or Republicans. While campaigning in 2008, both then-Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton pledged to fight the huge pharmaceutical and insurance industries. These promises echoed similar promises made by Mrs. Clinton during her husband's administration. Yet campaign contributions data showed that both Obama and Clinton were the largest recipients of Big Pharm donations in 2008 campaign funding. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Obama received $1,425,501 from the health service sector and health maintenance organizations, or HMOs, while Clinton came in second with $575,746 in contributions. Trailing both Obama and Clinton were $427,228 for John McCain and $186,700 for Mitt Romney. Only an awakened American public can rein in the power of the globalists' pharmaceutical monopoly, concluded Angel. Drug companies have the largest lobby in Washington, and they give copiously to political campaigns. Legislators are now so beholden to the pharmaceutical industry that it will be exceedingly difficult to break its lock on them. But the one thing legislators need more than campaign contributions is votes. That is why citizens should know what is really going on. Contrary to the industry's public relations, they don't get what they pay for. The fact is that this industry is taking us for a ride, and there will be no real reform without an aroused and determined public to make it happen. Drugging the kids. In years past, if a child was acting up or caught staring out the window, he or she received a rap on the knuckles with a ruler and was told to stay with the rest of the class. Today, the child is sent to the school nurse, who often tells the parents the student has been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, and advises them to see a psychiatrist who usually recommends the administration of Prozac, 94% sodium fluoride, Ritalin, or Zoloft, psychotropic drugs that have been shown to produce psychoses in lab rats. At least one state has put a stop to this practice. In 2001, the Connecticut House of Representatives voted 141-0 on a law prohibiting school personnel from recommending to parents that their children take Ritalin or other mood-altering drugs. One of the bill's primary sponsors, Republican State Representative Lenny Winkler, quoted studies showing the numbers of children taking Ritalin nationally jumped from 500,000 in 1987 to more than 6 million by 2001. The bill also prohibited the State Department of Children and Families from taking children away from parents who declined to put their children on mood-altering drugs. If the fact that unaware parents are being urged to drug their children is bad enough, consider that the effectiveness of the medication they're being asked to use has come under scrutiny. A 1999 study at the Human Development Center at the University of Wisconsin in Eau Claire found that 13 ADHD children on medication performed progressively worse over 4 years on standardized tests than a group of 13 normal children with similar IQs and other characteristics. Another study by Dr. Gretchen Lefevre, an assistant professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at Eastern Virginia Medical School, revealed that while children in her community use the drug Ritalin 2 to 3 times more than the national rate, their academic performance in relation to their peers showed no improvement. Her persistence in questioning the rising incidence of drug use in school children was muted in 2005 when she was fired. Alan Larson, a former secretary of the Oregon Federation of Independent Schools, criticized the expanding diagnosis of attention deficit disorder, ADD, stating, "The labeling of children with ADD is not because of a problem the kids have. It is because of a problem teachers who cannot tolerate active children have." Other questionable diagnoses include syndromes concerning children who are victims of obesity, junk food, lack of exercise, and inattentive parents. Clearly, some children have serious mental disorders, but these are relatively few compared with the number of currently medicated children. There is also the possibility that some of the diagnoses that doctors give to children are for non-existent diseases. In his 1991 book, Toxic Psychiatry, psychiatrist Peter Breggin wrote, "Hyperactivity is the most frequent justification for drugging children. The difficult-to-control male child is certainly not a new phenomenon, but attempts to give him a medical diagnosis are the product of modern psychology and psychiatry. At first, psychiatrists called hyperactivity a brain disease. When no brain disease could be found, they changed it to minimal brain disease, or MBD. When no minimal brain disease could be found, the profession transformed the concept into minimal brain dysfunction. When no minimal brain dysfunction could be demonstrated, the label became attention deficit disorder. Now it's just assumed to be a real disease, regardless of the failure to prove it so." Biochemical imbalance is the code word, but there's no more evidence for that than there is for actual brain disease. Textbooks of psychological disorders blossomed in size after programs such as Project Paperclip brought German psychiatrists into the military and intelligence fields after World War II. In its 1952 Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, DSM, the American Psychiatric Association defined only 106 mental disorders. By the publication of DSM-4 in 1994, the number had grown to 374. Meanwhile, the number of child psychologists in U.S. schools grew from a mere 500 in 1940 to more than 22,000 by 1990. In 2006, the number of school psychologists, including clinical and consultation, had grown to 152,000, with an anticipated 176,000 by 2016. The unscientific and political nature of psychiatry was noted in a resignation letter to the APA from Dr. Lauren R. Mosher, former chief of the Center for Studies of Schizophrenia at the National Institute of Mental Health. Why must the APA pretend to know more than it does? DSM-4 is the fabrication upon which psychiatry seeks acceptance by medicine in general. Insiders know it is more a political than scientific document. It is the way to get paid. This growth of an immense and well-funded field of psychiatry is worrisome to those who recall that in both Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, the incarcerations and, ultimately, the genocides practiced there all began innocuously as mental health programs. Persons who were considered defective, either physically or mentally, were the first victims of the Nazis, long before they turned to the Jews. Today, though psychiatry may still be suspect among the public, it has won over both government and the media. The profession and its treatments inundate talk shows, magazines, and the front pages of our papers, wrote Bruce Wiseman, the U.S. National President of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights and former chairman of the History Department at John F. Kennedy University. Lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD, was initially studied as an antipsychotic and antidepressant, as well as a truth drug by the military. When LSD was outlawed in 1968 for its dangerous side effects, drug companies sought substitutes. They developed the antidepressant Prozac, fluoxetine, then Zoloft, sertraline, Effexor, venlafaxine, and Paxil, paroxetine. These companies also developed the drug Ritalin. Long after the war, Dr. Helmut Remschmidt proposed a genetic answer to hyperactivity and was a leading proponent of the use of drugs such as Ritalin. Remschmidt was the director of the Society for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and studied under Dr. Hermann Stutt, a man associated with Nazi psychiatrists involved in the German euthanasia program. Remschmidt received his doctorate from Robert Sommer, director of the Deutscher Verband für Psychische Hygiene, or the German Association for Mental Hygiene, the institution that in the late 1920s laid the psychiatric groundwork for the idea of mental hygiene. The end result of this attempt at eugenics was the hands-on Nazi sterilization and euthanasia programs that led to the Holocaust. Long after the war, Remschmidt still proposed a genetic answer to hyperactivity and was a leading proponent of the use of drugs such as Ritalin. Could it be that Ritalin is doing more harm than good? A 1986 edition of the International Journal of the Addictions listed 105 adverse reactions to Ritalin, including serious ones such as dangerously high blood pressure, aggressiveness, restlessness, hallucinations, unusual behavior, and suicidal tendencies. Investigative reporter Kelly Patricia O'Meara spent 16 years working as a congressional staffer before writing investigative articles for Insight magazine. Her reports on child vaccines and mood-altering drugs prompted congressional hearings. She wrote, 30 years ago, the World Health Organization, WHO, concluded that Ritalin was pharmacologically similar to cocaine in the pattern of abuse it fostered, and cited it as a Schedule II drug, the most addictive in medical use. The Department of Justice also cited Ritalin as a Schedule II drug under the Controlled Substances Act, and the Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA, warned that Ritalin substitutes for cocaine and deamphetamine in a number of behavioral paradigms. O'Meara referenced a 2001 study at the Brookhaven National Laboratory that confirmed the similarities between cocaine and Ritalin, but found that Ritalin is more potent than cocaine in its effect on the dopamine system, an area of the brain many doctors believe is most affected by such narcotics. Although Americans wonder why there has been a rash of school shootings and teen suicides in recent years, few take into account that virtually all of these killings have involved a student who was on, or was just coming off, mood-altering drugs. In 5 cases of school shootings between March 1998 and May 1999, including the tragedy at Columbine High School, the students involved with the shootings were medicated. Though it was downplayed by the media, Sung-Hui Cho, the gunman in the Virginia Tech shootings in April 2007, had been undergoing psychological counseling and possessed prescription psychoactive drugs. In his book, Reclaiming Our Children, psychiatrist and drug critic Dr. Peter Bregan argued that Eric Harris's violence at Columbine was caused by the prescription drug Luvox. I also warned that stopping antidepressants can be as dangerous as starting them, since they can cause very disturbing and painful withdrawal reactions, said Dr. Bregan. The claim that drugs are behind school shootings was echoed as far back as a 1999 article in Health and Healing, written by Dr. Julian Whitaker. Virtually all of the gun-related massacres that have made headlines over the past decade have had one thing in common. They were perpetrated by people taking Prozac, Zoloft, Luvox, Paxil, or a related antidepressant drug. A website called TeenScreenTruth.com is dedicated to gathering information off the internet to help teens connect the dots to see the revealing connections between mood-altering drugs and teen violence. The site compiled a list of violent episodes dating as far back as 1985, when Stephen W. Brownlee, an Atlanta postal worker on psychotropic drugs, killed 2 co-workers. Despite sealed medical records, the sheer totality of evidence pointing to psychiatric drugs as the culprit behind most school shootings, teen suicides, and other violent behavior is most compelling, if not overwhelming. It would appear from the evidence that German drug science and German psychiatry have provided the foundation for today's schools, where children increasingly are being steered to drugs for any complaint, from true antisocial behavior to merely daydreaming. The effort by Big Pharm to mold education, physicians, politicians, and even healthcare in general to its will requires massive amounts of money. Such great sums are only available to the globalists, with Nazi roots and well beyond the reach of even well-off Americans, thanks to a crumbling economy and never-before-seen debt. Psychiatry and eugenics. By applying psychological techniques developed by the Germans, Big Pharm, the corporate mass media, and even education have been turned into tools for mind control. But before examining how this has occurred, one must first understand the history of psychology and psychiatry. History of psychiatry. Prior to the late 1800s, the mentally ill were treated little better than torture victims, chained to the walls of basements, cages, or dungeons, beaten and subjected to therapies such as bloodletting, partial drowning, and primitive shock treatments. A change to these treatment methods came when, in the 1860s, German medical doctor Wilhelm Maximilian Wundt proposed the idea that man is simply a higher-order animal, and that feeling and emotions may be studied and altered scientifically rather than through physical punishment. Wundt's work emphasized the physiological relationship of the brain and the mind, He explored the nature of religious beliefs, denied the human soul, and began to identify mental disorders and abnormal behavior, which led to the creation of the field of psychology. His Lectures on the Mind of Humans and Animals was published in 1863, and a year later, he was promoted to assistant professor of physiology at Heidelberg University. There, his work continued, and with the support of German militarists and aristocrats, he became known as the father of experimental psychology. Wundt, who found studies of the human soul incompatible with scientific empirical investigation, set out to explain what had previously been metaphysical matters in terms of mere animalistic and body chemical reactions. Many believe that Wundt's studies, as well as other European studies of the human mind, were major influences on the Nazi eugenics programs, which ultimately led to some of the greatest horrors of the 20th century. Thus, some of Germany's most learned men provided justification for Nazi euthanasia and extermination programs. Hitler's philosophy and his concept of man in general was shaped to a decisive degree by psychiatry. An influential cluster of psychiatrists and their frightening theories and methods collectively form the missing piece of the puzzle of Hitler, the Third Reich, the atrocities, and their dreadful legacy. It is the overlooked yet utterly central piece of the puzzle, wrote Dr. Thomas Roeder and his co-authors Volker Kubeles and Anthony Burwell in their 1995 book Psychiatrists, The Men Behind Hitler. Psychology, the scientific study of the human mind, and psychiatry, the study and treatment of mental disorders, go hand in hand and led to a viewpoint that certain people, endowed with better education and presumably understanding, were more competent to judge the behavior of others. As the field of psychiatry grew, so did its definitions, often to the point of absurdity. In 1871, a paper was published entitled Psychical Degeneration of the French People, which purported that simply being French constituted a mental illness. One of psychiatry's leading figures, Richard von Krafft Ebing, added to his list of varieties of mental disorders political and reformatory insanity, meaning any inclination to form a different opinion from that of the masses, stated Roeder, Kubeles, and Burwell. At the time of World War I, the attempt to bring respectability to the emerging psychiatric profession resulted in a certain bond that had been created between psychiatry and the aristocratic German government. The German military was particularly interested with the treatment of Fritz Kaufmann's electroshock therapy because it helped minimize war neurosis or shell shock and quickly returned disturbed soldiers to the front. It was more of a disciplinary measure than true medical therapy. After being electrically shocked, most soldiers quickly agreed to return to service. Psychiatry continued to grow in power even as its agenda continued to widen. Psychiatrist P.J. Mobius, who had lectured on the psychological feeble-mindedness of the woman, pronounced, "The psychiatrist should be the judge about mental health, because only he knows what ill means." The rush to isolate and cure mental defectives in Nazi Germany quickly was interpreted to include malcontents and dissidents opposed to Hitler's regime. This concept resulted in the Nazi Sterilization Act, which went into effect in July 1933, just 6 months after Hitler's ascension to power. This law provided for the compulsory sterilization of anyone deemed defective, deficient, or undesirable by the state. One of the leading and articulate authorities behind this act was Dr. Ernst Rudin, a psychiatrist who in 1930 had traveled to Washington, D.C. to present a paper on the importance of eugenics and genetics in mental hygiene. It was well received by many Americans, especially among the globalists, who had come to embrace the racist and elitist views of the German philosophers, such as Georg Hegel, Friedrich Nietzsche, Martin Heidegger, and Rudolf Steiner. Just after Hitler took office in 1933, Rudin, by then director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, supported the law for the prevention of genetically diseased children, the initial step toward the sterilization of those deemed unworthy of life. Rudin continued to be acknowledged as a leader in psychiatry. In 1992, the prestigious Max Planck Institute praised Rudin for following his own convictions in racial hygiene measures, cooperating with the Nazis as a psychiatrist, and helping them legitimize their aims through pertinent legislation. Prescott Bush, the father and grandfather of two U.S. presidents, along with being a member of the secretive Skull and Bones fraternity, was among those Yale activists promoting the Mental Hygiene Society. This organization evolved into the World Federation of Mental Health, which included the prominent Montague Norman, a former partner of Brown Brothers, governor of the Bank of England, 1920 through 1944, and godfather to Nazi banker Hjalmar Schacht's grandson. Norman, himself a mental patient, appointed Brigadier General John Rawlings Rees, the former chief psychiatrist and psychological warfare expert for British intelligence, as the director of the Tavistock Psychiatric Clinic. Dr. John Rawlings Rees, a co-founder of the World Federation for Mental Health, spelled out the Federation's agenda before the annual general meeting of the National Council for Mental Hygiene on June 18, 1940. We can therefore justifiably stress our particular point of view with regard to the proper development of the human psyche, even though our knowledge be incomplete. We must aim to make it permeate every educational activity in our national life. We have made a useful attack upon a number of professions. The two easiest of them, naturally, are the teaching profession and the church. The two most difficult are law and medicine. Public life, politics, and industry should all of them be within our sphere of influence. If we are to infiltrate the professional and social activities of other people, I think we must imitate the totalitarians and organize some kind of fifth column activity. If better ideas on mental health are to progress and spread, we, as the salesmen, must lose our identity. Let us all, therefore, very secretly, be fifth columnists. Beverly K. Eakman, an author and a commissioner for the Citizens Commission on Rights, wrote, "Colleagues of Rees, such as Canadian doctors Brock Chisholm and Ewan Cameron, progressive U.S. educators like Edward Thorndike, James Earl Russell, John Dewey, and Benjamin Bloom, and a bevy of foundations, associations, and tax-supported research centers, became Rees's enablers. This cadre of like-minded and self-styled experts first seized upon Russian Ivan Pavlov's classic conditioning, followed that up with German psychologist Kurt Lewin's group dynamics, Russian neuropsychologist Alexander Luria's disorganization of behavior, and the U.S. psychologist B.F. Skinner's deprivation-based operant conditioning, coupled with U.S. social psychologist Elliot Aronson's cognitive dissonance. Together they created Rees's dream, a controlled psychological environment. Today, the Department of Defense, DOD, has a new name for it, Perception Management, or PM, and the psychopharmaceutical industry has hit the jackpot. Perception management to the Department of Defense simply means getting the public to respond as DOD officials wish without their realizing it. Knee-jerk reactions, leaving reason behind, much like subliminal advertising. An early yet clear use of this technique was the name change in 1947 from the War Department to the Defense Department. In so doing, the subject of perception management is thrust unawares into the twisted view of reality. In today's politically correct environment, this unorthodox technique is sold as intellectual and academic freedom, explained Beverly Eakman. Similarly, encounter sessions or therapy groups are predicated on fostering emotional toughness. Facilitators lead participants to accept ideas and deportment they normally would not tolerate. What they actually get is re-education, Soviet style. Schools of behavioral science, such as Esalen Institute and the Western Training Laboratory for Group Development, allude to consensus group thinking as being the objective. Encounter groups deliberately heighten peer pressure, isolating holdouts of a viewpoint and intimidating weaker individuals by ridiculing them, cursing at them, yelling at them, and ostracizing them until they cave. Some even commit suicide. That's why NTL, the National Training Laboratories Institute, for example, carries a disclaimer which the applicant must sign prior to admission, stating, "No person concerned about entering a stress situation should participate in NTL programs. A small percentage of participants have experienced stress reactions in varying degrees. There is no means of predicting such reactions or screening out or otherwise identifying those predisposed to such reactions." Now, any thoughtful person upon reading this would realize that the very concept of psychological screening must be a sham. If psychologists are unable to predict or screen out individuals predisposed to become upset by NTL's daunting program, then how do they expect to screen the entire population for mental illness? Yet just such an initiative was funded by Congress in 2002, with copycat bills set for launch in several states. Could our nation's leaders be looking to avert political dissent under the pretext of preventing emotional diseases? Wouldn't be the first time. Eugenics. The perception management activities of twisting semantics and promoting groupthink were psychological methods employed by the German Nazis that resulted in the deaths of millions of innocents as a matter of state policy. A holocaust in anyone's book. Although most Americans are aware of the horrors inflicted by Hitler's Nazis on Europe's citizens in pursuit of their creating a master race, and many see eugenics as a racist pseudoscience seeking to eliminate anyone whom a self-proclaimed elite views as undesirable, few realize that the theological and scientific basis for the Nazis' beliefs originated in the United States, particularly in California, long before the Nazis came to power in Germany. In the late 19th century, the United States had joined 14 other nations in passing various types of eugenics legislation. 30 states had laws providing for the sterilization of mental patients and imbeciles. At least 60,000 such defectives were legally sterilized. In 1925, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, writing for the majority in a Supreme Court case, stated, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind." Sir Francis Galton, English psychologist and father of the eugenics movement, defined eugenics as "the science of improving the stock to give more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable." In order to determine who was dirtying the gene pool requires extensive comprehensive statistics on the population. So in 1910, the Eugenics Records Office was established as a branch of the Galton National Laboratory in London, endowed by Mrs. E. H. Harriman, wife of the U.S. railroad magnate Edward Harriman and mother of diplomat and early-day globalist Averill Harriman. After 1900, the Harrimans, the family that gave Prescott Bush's family their start, along with the Rockefellers, provided more than $11 million to create the privately owned Eugenics Records Office of Charles B. Davenport at Cold Springs Harbor, New York, as well as eugenic studies at Harvard, Columbia, and Cornell. The first International Congress of Eugenics was convened in London in 1912, with Winston Churchill as a director. Clearly, the concept of bloodlines was as significant to the British and American elite as it was to Hitler and the Nazis. In 1932, when the Congress met in New York, it was the Hamburg America Shipping Line, controlled by Harriman associates George Walker and Prescott Bush, that brought prominent Germans to the meeting. In attendance was Dr. Ernst Rudin, aforementioned authority behind the Nazi Sterilization Act, and member of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Genealogy and Demography in Berlin. Rudin was unanimously elected president of the International Federation of Eugenics Societies for his work in founding the Deutsche Gesellschaft für Rassenhygiene, or the German Society for Racial Hygiene, a forerunner of Hitler's racial institutes. But as stated previously, the groundwork for eugenics was laid in the United States. California was considered the epicenter of the American eugenics movement, according to Edwin Black, author of War Against the Weak, Eugenics and America's Campaign to Create a Master Race. During the 20th century's first decades, California's eugenicists included potent but little-known race scientists, such as Army venereal disease specialist Dr. Paul Popenoe, citrus magnate and polytechnic benefactor Paul Gosney, Sacramento banker Charles M. Goeth, as well as members of the California State Board of Charities and Corrections and the University of California Board of Regents, wrote Black. Black said that within the first 25 years of eugenics legislation, California sterilized 9,782 individuals, mostly women, many of whom were classified as bad girls or diagnosed as passionate, oversexed, or sexually wayward. Some women were sterilized because of what was deemed an abnormally large clitoris or labia. In 1933 alone, Black found at least 1,278 compulsory sterilizations were performed, 700 of which were on women. He said California's two leading sterilization mills in 1933 were Sonoma State Home with 388 operations and Patton State Hospital with 363 operations. Other sterilizations were also performed in centers at Agnews, Mendocino, Napa, Norwalk, Stockton, and Pacific Colony. Black noted, "Eugenics would have been so much bizarre parlor talk had it not been for extensive financing by corporate philanthropies, specifically the Carnegie Institution, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Harriman Railroad fortune. They were all in league with some of America's most respected scientists, hailing from such prestigious universities as Stanford, Yale, Harvard, and Princeton. These academicians espoused race theory and race science, and then faked and twisted data to serve eugenics' racist aims." He described how the Rockefeller Foundation helped create the German eugenics movement and even funded the program that the infamous Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele worked in before he became the Angel of Death at Auschwitz. The grand plan was to literally wipe away the reproductive capability of those deemed weak and inferior, the so-called unfit, said Black. The eugenicists hoped to neutralize the viability of 10% of the population at a sweep until none were left except themselves. One solution offered was simply execution or euthanasia, as listed in a 1911 study funded by the Carnegies entitled Preliminary Report of the Committee of the Eugenics Section of the American Breeders Association to Study and to Report on the Best Practical Means for cutting off the defective germplasm in the human population. Interestingly enough, the most popular idea for euthanasia in the United States at that time was the employment of gas chambers. Black concluded, "Hitler studied American eugenics laws. He tried to legitimize his anti-Semitism by medicalizing it and wrapping it in the more palatable pseudo-scientific facade of eugenics. Hitler was able to recruit more followers among reasonable Germans by claiming that science was on his side. When Hitler's race hatred sprung from his own mind, the intellectual outlines of the eugenics Hitler adopted in 1924 were made in America." Despite much public renunciation of eugenics following the revelations of the Nazi racial extermination programs at the Nuremberg trials, work on population control continues right up to today under more politically correct names. Some conspiracy-oriented researchers see the fingerprints of eugenics theology in today's efforts to reduce the human population, as previously discussed. Many of the same families and foundations that support birth control organizations today were connected to the eugenics movement of the past. According to its summary of financial activities ending in June 2008, Planned Parenthood ended the year with $966.7 million in revenues. Of this amount, $349.6 million came from unspecified government grants and contracts, compared to $374.7 million from its health care centers and $186 million in private contributions and bequests.